Hello, and welcome to Grand Dukes of the West, Episode 37, Matrimonial Mayhem and Havoc in Hainaut. Today, we're picking up where we left off in Episode 33, with the story of Jacqueline of Bavaria. The Countess of Hainaut, Holland, and Zealand, in title, but not in practice, arrived in London in early 1421. The past 4 years had been difficult for her, as she dealt with a hostile uncle determined to seize her patrimony, and an incompetent husband who refused to defend it. Jacqueline's uncle, John the Pitiless, the Bishop of Liège, moved to usurp the counties of Holland and Zealand after the death of her father, William of Bavaria. John the Pitiless had taken advantage of the disorder in the counties, mostly due to the conflict between the Hook and Cod factions, in order to press his claim. In an attempt to strengthen Jacqueline's position and to consolidate the Burgundian presence in the Low Countries, the Countess of Hainaut, Holland, Zealand was married to her cousin, John the Fourth, Duke of Brabant. However, this match was a bad one. The two had conflicting personalities and interests, and the match soon became toxic. Worse still, her husband seemed to take the side of Jacqueline's uncle in their battle for Holland and Zealand. After a fumbled military campaign against the now former Bishop of Liège, John the Fourth came to terms with John the Pitiless, terms which completely undermined Jacqueline's rights in the counties. From here, Jacqueline and John's marriage only got worse. And, finally fed up with her husband's inaction and abuse, the Countess of Hainaut, Holland, Zealand renounced her husband, requested an annulment for her marriage, fled the Low Countries, and sought refuge with King Henry V of England. Henry welcomed Jacqueline to England with open arms, despite the opposition of Philip the Good. It's possible that the King of England had his own ambitions in the Low Countries, but given how vital the Burgundian alliance was to the Lancastrian project in France, it was more likely that Henry was simply moved by sympathy for the Countess. In England, Jacqueline of Bavaria received the honors that were kept from her in the Low Countries. She was given a comfortable pension to live on and became a part of the English court, even serving as the godmother to the soon-to-be Henry VI. The English acknowledged her separation from John IV of Brabant and supported her claims to Hainaut, Holland, and Zealand. The Duke of Burgundy had been trying to reconcile Jacqueline and John IV before her flight to England, and so didn't take kindly to his supposed ally interfering with his dynastic plans. But all in all, her presence in England, while disagreeable to Philip, wasn't a major issue during the lifetime of Henry V. John IV still held Hainaut and refused to accept his separation, and John the Pitiless still held Holland and Zealand. Jacqueline could assert that she was single and the rightful countess of all three, but the situation on the ground did not change much after her flight. However, upon the death of Henry V, things got more complicated. Mere weeks after his brother's death, Humphrey, Duke of Gloucester, declared his intention to marry Jacqueline of Bavaria. The timing of this declaration suggests that the late King of England, while sympathetic to Jacqueline, would not endanger his alliance with Burgundy on her behalf, and refused to allow his brother's ambitions in the Low Countries to interfere with his own ambitions in France. But with the king dead, Humphrey and Jacqueline acted quickly, and notably, this betrothal was announced before the Pope had responded to Jacqueline's petition for an annulment to her marriage with John IV. Some historians have claimed that seeing that Pope Martin V would not grant an annulment for the marriage, Jacqueline and Humphrey turned to Benedict XIII for an annulment. Benedict had been the Pope based in Avignon during the Western Schism and never accepted his deposition at the Council of Constance a few years earlier. It is possible that this happened, but it is largely dismissed nowadays, as for one, neither England nor the Low Countries recognized Benedict's authority before he was deposed, and certainly not after. But while likely false, this story does illustrate the eagerness that both Humphrey and Jacqueline had for the marriage. Because, in early 1423, shortly after their initial betrothal, and still without an annulment from Pope Martin, Humphrey and Jacqueline wed. The Duke of Gloucester immediately began styling himself as the Count of Hainaut, Holland, and Zealand, and made it clear to all that he had every intention of claiming his wife's counties by force if necessary. Humphrey's marriage and ambitions immediately created a headache for his brother, John, Duke of Bedford. Bedford had been left in charge of Lancastrian France and knew just how vital the English alliance with Burgundy was for the success of that project. Humphrey and Jacqueline's marriage not only threatened the alliance, but the Duke of Gloucester's plans to recover his wife's lands also threatened to divert men and money away from the French war effort. Bedford and his uncles, the Beauforts, worked to limit Gloucester's power in England. After the death of Henry V, Humphrey had claimed the Regency of England, but when he attempted to secure that position, he was faced with widespread opposition. Instead of a single regent, a regency council was created. Gloucester was made the head of this council, at least when Bedford was in France, but the council itself was mostly composed of his opponents. So Bedford and the Beauforts could at least rest easy in the knowledge that Humphrey's attempts to divert war funds to the Low Countries would be hampered. However, Jacqueline and Humphrey were not willing to give up their claims, and could still recruit soldiers and raise money through their own networks of patronage in England and the Low Countries. So throughout 1423 and 1424, they did just that, as John of Bedford and Philip the Good worked to resolve the situation before a conflict could break out. The Dukes of Bedford and Burgundy held many summits to discuss the war against the Dauphin and the future of France in these years, and in all of these meetings, the topic of Humphrey and Jacqueline was always brought up. As the Duke and Duchess of Gloucester's preparations to go to the Low Countries went on, both Bedford and Burgundy searched for a diplomatic solution. And in early summer 1424, Burgundy and Bedford finally convinced Humphrey and Jacqueline to submit to their arbitration. But the Duke of Burgundy had no intention of allowing Hainaut to be taken from his easily dominated cousin, John IV, and given to the much more independent pair of Humphrey and Jacqueline, while the Duke of Bedford considered keeping Burgundy happy to be far more important than keeping his brother happy. So between Philip's bias and John of Bedford's lack of interest in defending his brother's claims, it should not be surprising that their arbitration did not end up being to the benefit of Jacqueline of Bavaria and Humphrey of Gloucester. The terms decided on by Bedford and Burgundy were mostly an attempt to pacify the couple, and they did not seriously consider Jacqueline's demands. The terms boiled down to allowing John IV to remain in control of Hainaut and John the Pitiless to remain in control of Holland and Zealand for the time being, in exchange for a pension for Jacqueline, and having the Pope rule on the legitimacy of Jacqueline's marriages to both John IV and Humphrey of Gloucester to decide the issue in the long run. Essentially, the status quo. As should have been expected, Jacqueline and Humphrey refused this deal, and a few months later they arrived in Calais with an army of around 4,000 men. The target of their expedition was Hainaut, which was chosen for a few reasons. First, Jacqueline had always been more accepted in Hainaut than her other two counties. Second, a campaign against the ineffectual John IV was likely to be easier than one against the energetic John the Pitiless. Third, John the Pitiless's hold on Holland and Zealand was based on an agreement with John IV. So if John IV's claim on Jacqueline's lands was successfully challenged, John the Pitiless's legitimacy would be hurt too. And finally, this easier campaign in Hainaut would give the Duke and Duchess of Gloucester a useful base in the Low Countries to prepare for their fight against John the Pitiless. As Jacqueline and Humphrey made plans to march on Hainaut, Burgundy and Bedford once more demanded that all parties involved refrain from hostilities and submit to their arbitration. Jacqueline and Humphrey refused, but John IV, ever willing to follow Philip's instructions, agreed, and even stood down the army he had been assembling for the defense of Hainaut. The result of this demand was thus that Humphrey and Jacqueline were able to march into Hainaut virtually unopposed. There were several Brabantine garrisons in the county, but those would prove to be largely inconsequential and mostly didn't put up a fight. The people of Hainaut were fairly happy to welcome their countess back home, but had some reservations about Humphrey. Jacqueline was their rightful ruler, after all, but Humphrey and his English army smelled of foreign military occupation. However, in part due to the lack of resistance from John IV, and consequently the lack of violence from the English, Humphrey's entrance into Hainaut took place without incident. Just about all the towns and castles of the county submitted to Jacqueline and her new husband, and the English force was dispersed into garrisons that were once held by Brabantine soldiers. There were a few holdouts whose loyalties lay with John IV, and by extension Philip the Good, rather than Jacqueline, but these were the exception rather than the rule. Jacqueline and Humphrey gathered the estates of Hainaut in the town of Mons in December 1424. There, the estates formally recognized the dissolution of Jacqueline's marriage to John IV, as well as the validity of her marriage to Humphrey, and recognized her new husband as the Count of Hainaut. However, just as Jacqueline and Humphrey were basking in the glow of their easy and uneventful victory in Hainaut, Philip the Good was making preparations to undo that and return the county to his cousin. No, not Jacqueline, his other cousin, John IV. Now you might be asking, why is Philip only jumping into action now, and why didn't he prevent Hainaut from falling to Humphrey and Jacqueline in the first place? I'm not 100% sure, but I do have a few ideas why. First, by having John IV agree to the ceasefire declared by Burgundy and Bedford, Philip was able to paint John as the aggrieved party, and paint Jacqueline and Humphrey as aggressive and unreasonable. Second, it's possible that Philip's own preparations for a conflict against Jacqueline and Humphrey were still ongoing, and he figured that it would be better to wait to march against them. And third, by letting Hainaut slip from John IV's grasp, Philip could arrange to hold the county himself upon its reconquest. The Burgundian Brabantine army was led by John IV's brother, Philip, Count of Saint-Pol. Joining him were John of Luxembourg, his brother Peter, and Jean de Villiers de l'Isle-Adam. These men were loyal Burgundians, but they were also major figures in the Lancastrian war effort, so their absence from France and presence in this army would have likely needed to be approved of by John of Bedford. While the Duke of Bedford was not openly opposing his brother Humphrey's ambitions, he definitely saw the Burgundian alliance as more important than those ambitions. After a few months of preparations, the Burgundian force entered Hainaut in March of 1425. Their first target was Braine-l'Comte, a fortified town held by the English on the road to Jacqueline's capital of Mons. Braine was a tough nut to crack, so Philip of Saint-Pol settled in for a siege. The Duke of Gloucester led an English force to try and raise the siege of Braine, but he didn't actually do anything to stop Saint-Pol. He set up camp near the town, but stood by as Philip prepared to take Braine-l'Comte. The English garrison holding Braine surrendered a few days after Humphrey arrived in the area. The reason for the quick surrender of the garrison could be linked to Humphrey's refusal to fight Saint-Pol, or to the fact that it was being heavily bombarded by cannon fire. But there was also a rumor spreading throughout the town that St. George, the patron saint of England, had been seen atop a white horse, fighting alongside the Burgundians and the Brabanders during an attack on the town. This rumor was actually not as far-fetched as it sounds, as one of the Brabander knights present in the army shared the same coat of arms as St. George, and had brought a white horse with him on campaign. But whether the reason for its surrender was military or spiritual, Braine gave in somewhat unexpectedly. After the fall of Braine, Humphrey challenged Philip of Saint-Pol to a battle. But again, nothing happened. Both sides just lined up in battle formation near the town, and kept waiting for the other to initiate the battle until night fell. Both armies then withdrew, and soon after, a one-month truce was declared. This truce wasn't actually linked to this non-battle, but rather to the correspondence between Philip the Good and Humphrey of Gloucester. They hadn't made peace, quite the opposite in fact. After a series of increasingly hostile letters, The two princes decided that single combat was the best way to move forward. Both were calling the other the true aggressor and accusing them of shedding Christian blood unjustly, with some insults thrown in here and there. Philip evidently felt that his honor had been impugned by Humphrey, and so decided to kill two birds with one stone. The question of personal honor and the question of Hainaut could both be settled by a duel, and thus only one person would have to die. Humphrey accepted Philip's challenge, and the duel was scheduled for St. George's Day, but it seemed that the Duke of Burgundy was far more eager than the Duke of Gloucester for the duel. And for that matter, the Duke of Burgundy was far more eager for the duel than any of the members of his court. Philip immediately went on a diet, began exercising more, and summoned a number of skilled swordsmen to help him train. He also had a new set of armor made for the occasion, as well as liveries created for himself and a number of companions. On the other hand, many of Philip's advisors thought that this was a terrible idea, and immediately tried to convince the Duke to delay or cancel the duel, without success. As Philip was preparing for the duel, his opponent was leaving the Low Countries. Humphrey, Duke of Gloucester, left Hainaut for Calais towards the end of March, along with his army, and about a week and a half before the duel was scheduled to take place, he and his army returned to England. His stated reason for this was to prepare for the duel, as well as to gather a new army for a coming campaign against Brabant. But there were many other factors at play. For one, his domestic position in England was faltering in his absence, and the Beauforts were working to marginalize him while he was out of the kingdom. Furthermore, the English presence in Hainaut was expensive, and he needed money to pay the army he currently had, and the one he promised to raise. And finally, the honeymoon phase of his marriage might have ended by now, and notably, he did return to England with a mistress. He may have wanted a break from Jacqueline. Regardless of whether or not Humphrey had returned to England to avoid facing Philip, the decision of whether or not to fight was taken out of his hands. The Pope had been notified of the duel and condemned it, and the Duke of Bedford, who had been called on to officiate the duel, was doing everything in his power to prevent it from taking place. John of Bedford even called a court of honor, where he officially ruled that none of the content in the letters had been extreme enough to be considered a slight against the recipient's honor, so a duel would not be necessary. Furthermore, Bedford made it abundantly clear to his brother that no duel would be taking place, and he better not do anything to further endanger England's alliance with Burgundy. Do you hear me, Humphrey? Quit it. Back in England, Humphrey's attempts to secure more men and money for a second expedition to Hainaut were hampered by the Beauforts and Bedford's other allies on the Regency Council. So, St. George's Day came and went with no duel taking place, and as the truce expired, the Burgundian-Brabantine army resumed their advance into Hainaut. Their task was made easier by the continued absence of Humphrey and the English army. Now, Jacqueline was left with only a small force of loyal Hainaut knights in attendance. They were obviously no match for Philip of Saint-Pol's army, and so as he marched further into the county, he was met with little resistance, and just about all the nobles and towns gave in without a fight. Before long, Jacqueline's capital of Mons was the only place in Hainaut holding out for her. As the Burgundian-Brabantine army approached, Jacqueline wrote a series of increasingly desperate letters to her husband and other allies appealing for aid. Her repudiated husband, John IV of Brabant, joined his brother, Philip of Saint-Pol, outside of Mons in May 1425, and the brothers began a siege of Jacqueline's last stronghold. After a month-long siege, Jacqueline was still defiant, but the people of Mons had had enough. Some Burgundian sympathizers in the city organized a coup where they arrested several important supporters of the Countess and opened talks with the besieging army. They then went to Jacqueline and told her that they were not strong enough to stand against the forces of Brabant and Burgundy, and so they would surrender with or without her permission. She could either agree to terms, or they would deliver her to the Dukes of Burgundy and Brabant. Seeing the walls closing in, Jacqueline agreed to hand herself over to John IV. She pleaded with him to be allowed to settle in Brabant rather than be handed over to the Duke of Burgundy. But John had already agreed to send her to Flanders, where she would be held by Philip the Good until the Pope officially ruled on who she was actually married to. John handed Jacqueline over to one of Philip's men, who then escorted her to Ghent. With his entrance into Mons, the Duke of Brabant officially regained the government of Hainaut, but the man he appointed as his lieutenant in the county was a Burgundian agent, and shortly after this, John IV would formally invite Philip the Good to share in the government of the county. The night that the gates of Mons were open, Jacqueline wrote one more letter to Humphrey. In this letter, she called herself the most wickedly betrayed woman, and she had a point. Her cousins and uncle conspired to seize her inheritance, while her husbands had either fully cooperated with them or abandoned her. Those who swore to defend her had given in to her enemies, and now she was on her way to an imprisonment in all but name. We will return to Jacqueline shortly, but now we need to examine what's been going on in Jacqueline's northern counties, Holland and Zeeland. Because while Philip of Burgundy and Philip of St. Pol were preparing for the campaign into Hainaut, John the Pitiless met his end. One of John the Pitiless's court officers, Jan van Vliet, was approached by a group of discontented Hook noblemen and English agents and convinced to murder the Ruwart, or regent, of Holland and Zeeland. As Ruth Putnam puts it, quote, "Poison was provided from England and given to him, wrapped in a doeskin bag and closed in a little casket. Van Vliet found an opportunity of possessing himself of the Ruwart's prayer book, and, protecting his hand with a glove, he smeared the poison on the pages. He then threw the box into a vault and burned the glove, besides rubbing his hands on a wall and taking care not to touch food with his fingers for some time. The poison was only strong enough to make Duke John ill without killing him. Owing to this failure, Van Vliet was refused the 2,000 crowns promised him." The illness did eventually lead to John the Pitiless's death in January of 1425, and I personally find it ironic that the man who had forsaken his bishopric was killed by a prayer book. This version of events is contemporary and did come from Jan van Vliet himself, but it also did come to light as he was being tortured by agents of the late Ruwart, so who knows just how reliable it is. With the death of John of Bavaria, the counties of Holland and Zeeland were up for grabs once more. John the Pitiless had ruled Holland and Zeeland by virtue of a mortgage from John IV, who in turn claimed rulership of the counties as Jacqueline's legitimate husband, while Jacqueline maintained that she was always the rightful ruler of the counties, even while John the Pitiless was alive. Philip the Good had his own claims, as he had been named John the Pitiless's heir the year before, when the Ruwart thought that he might need Burgundian support against Jacqueline and Humphrey. Notably, this was only to John's personal estate rather than to the counties as a whole, as John the Pitiless had renounced his claims to be the Count of Holland and Zeeland as a part of a settlement with John IV. But it still entitled Philip to a number of important lordships, towns, and lands in Holland and Zeeland. So as the Ruwart fell ill, Philip made sure to keep himself informed of his health, and when he died, the Duke of Burgundy immediately made John IV ratify his extensive new holdings in the counties. Both John IV and Jacqueline asserted their right to rule Holland and Zeeland. However, as both were currently occupied elsewhere, the actual taking charge would have to be left to subordinates. Here, in this uncertain political situation, the tensions between Hook and Cod arose once again, or more accurately, the conflict moved from barely contained to back out in the open. The Hooks and Cods were political parties which formed in Holland and Zeeland in the 1350s. Their inciting event was a power struggle between Margaret of Avennes and her son William of Bavaria. Review Supplemental 8 for that. While the initial conflict was now decades past, the parties stuck around. Jacqueline's father, William II of Bavaria, had favored the Hooks, and John the Pitiless capitalized on years of Cod resentment to support his own quest for power. He allied himself with the Cods and exploited some local disturbances between the two factions to assert that a firm hand was needed in Holland. As Count and later Ruvart, John's power was based in the cities of Holland, which tended to be Cod's strongholds, specifically Delft, Leiden, Haarlem, The Hague, and Amsterdam, among others. While John the Pitiless ruled Holland and Zeeland, the Cod faction once more reigned supreme. Hook court officers and administrators were fired and replaced by Cods, and the Cods could rely on comital patronage in their disputes with the Hooks. So when John the Pitiless died, the Hooks saw a path back to power in supporting the claims of Jacqueline, while the Cods figured that the best way to maintain their dominance was to support the claims of John IV of Brabant and Philip the Good. John IV had been surrounding himself with advisors with links to the Cods for a while now, and Philip the Good had inherited John the Pitiless's network of patronage along with his personal territories. After John the Pitiless's death, both Jacqueline and Humphrey, and John IV and Philip the Good sent agents to link up with the Hooks and Cods respectively. While Jacqueline and Humphrey were preparing for Philip of Saumpol's invasion of Hainaut, John IV went to The Hague to officially resume his role as Count of Holland and Zeeland. The Cods lined up behind him and supported his claim, and, in turn, he confirmed the rights and privileges of the Cod towns, and doled out favors and patronage to the nobility of the faction. But not all of Holland and Zeeland declared for John IV. There was a notable Hook presence in southwest Holland, which made contact with Jacqueline, and began a campaign to try and take back the county. But the Cods were the stronger faction, and, with some help from the Dukes of Brabant and Burgundy, they were able to contain the Hook revolt, even if several Hook towns and nobles still refused to acknowledge John IV's claims to the counties. This latest round of conflict between the Hooks and the Cods was wrapping up around the same time that Jacqueline was forced out of Mons and handed to the Duke of Burgundy. With Hainaut, Holland, and Zeeland now largely accepting the rule of John IV promptly appointed Philip the Good, Ruvart of Holland and Zeeland for a period of 12 years, essentially giving him the same deal that John the Pitiless had. This was in addition to his sharing of the government of Hainaut with Philip, which was made official around the same time. So while John IV had emerged victorious from the struggle with his wife and cousin, the real winner was the Duke of Burgundy, who now ruled a huge swath of the Low Countries. With Jacqueline of Bavaria in his custody, and her counties accepting John IV, and by extension himself, the Duke of Burgundy met with John of Bedford to discuss the future of the Anglo-Burgundian alliance and the war against the Dauphin. Despite Philip's lagging interest in France, his minimal support for the Lancastrian war effort in recent years, and the tensions caused by Humphrey's marriage to Jacqueline, the meeting with the Duke of Bedford was good, and the Anglo-Burgundian alliance remained solid, in part due to Bedford's own marriage with Philip's sister Anne. There was one notable moment of tension during this summit, though. Apparently, some of the Burgundian knights present were wearing a certain emblem as a challenge to the English, and when the Duke of Bedford saw this emblem, he got offended and asked the knights to remove it. However, once it was explained to John of Bedford that this emblem was specifically a challenge against his brother Humphrey's claim to Hainaut, rather than the English in general, the Duke of Bedford was satisfied and allowed the emblems to remain. After all the frustration that Humphrey had caused him in pursuing Hainaut, Bedford had no interest in defending that claim. While Humphrey's plans for the Low Countries did threaten the Anglo-Burgundian alliance in general, they strengthened the personal alliance between Bedford and Burgundy. John of Bedford's interference against and intelligence on his brother had been key factors in the ease of Philip's initial victory over Gloucester. So while the threat of an English presence in the Low Countries unnerved the Duke of Burgundy, it also made breaking with the English more difficult. After this conference broke up, Philip began to consolidate his hold on Holland and Zeeland. To this end, he sent various delegations to members of the Cod faction and the major towns of the counties, with promises to respect their rights and privileges, and to spread around some bribes. He also planned to move Jacqueline out of Flanders, and thus further away from her counties. As Philip the Good plotted to get his cousin out of the way, literally, Jacqueline launched a plot of her own to escape his clutches. While the Countess was under guard in the Gravenstein Castle at Ghent, she wasn't imprisoned per se. Although the distinction was largely semantic, the Countess had much more freedom of movement than the average prisoner. So despite her confinement, Jacqueline was able to get into contact with the Hooks holding out in southwest Holland, and together they planned an escape. In early September 1425, Jacqueline requested privacy to take a bath. Her guards figured that this was fine and so left the room, whereupon Jacqueline and one of her attendants changed into men's clothing, which had been smuggled into the Gravenstein earlier that day. Jacqueline and her attendant then snuck out of her room through an unguarded door and simply walked out of the castle. They then met up with a couple of Hook nobles who had disguised themselves as merchants, and the group then rode from Ghent to Holland. Jacqueline's arrival in Holland was a boon to the Hooks, as it prompted many of the towns and nobles who had unhappily accepted John IV and Philip the Good's claims to Holland and Zealand to now reject them and declare for her. Jacqueline's base of operations was the town of Gouda in southwest Holland, and the area between Gouda and the other towns of Schoonhoven and Oudewater became her core territory over the next few years. Across the English Channel, Humphrey of Gloucester suddenly began to pay attention to the plight of his wife again, and renewed his attempts to raise money and men to come to her aid. When Philip the Good learned of his cousin's escape, he was unhappy, to say the least. He had gone to all this trouble in order to usurp her inheritance, and she had the audacity to try and resist that. The Duke of Burgundy was close to an unprecedented level of power in the Low Countries, but he would have to fight for it. Jacqueline's position was not as strong as Philip's was. She held a relatively small piece of Holland and did not have the resources and wealth that he could command. But she was the legitimate Countess of Holland and Zealand, and she would not go down without a fight. It will be 4 weeks rather than two until we see the cousins face off in their battle for Holland, as I will be on vacation. I'm excited to announce that this trip will include a brief stop in Burgundy, and I will do my best to take some good pictures for the website. Thank you so much to my patrons, with an extra thanks to my newest patron, David Graf von Barland, and to Christine, Duchesse de Nemours, Peter, Duc de Brancion, Elliot, Graf von Gravenstein, Anthony, Comte de Chateauneuf-en-Ossois, Preston, Comte de Saint-Fargeau, Mark, Comte de Mirceau, Diana, Graf von Biersel, Mehmet, Comte Santerre, Chris, Comte de Semur, David, Graf von Bornum, Rosa, Comte de Germol, Elliot, Comte de Bussy-le-Grand, Quentin, Graf von Blasfeld, Tyler, Comte de Chamaret, Ian, Graf von Arenberg, Eric, Comte de Couche, and to my Knights of the Duchy. If you want to join them, you can at patreon.com/valoisburgundy. If you want to support the podcast in other ways, you can do so by leaving a review on your podcast app of choice and telling your friends about the show. Both really help to grow the show and will earn you my everlasting appreciation. If you want to keep up with the show, you can follow me at ValoisBurgundy on Twitter or Blue Sky, or find Grand Dukes of the West on Facebook. You can also email me at granddukesofthewest@gmail.com and check out the podcast website for maps, images, sources, and more at granddukesofthewest.com. Once again, thank you for listening.